Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A look back at 2019 and the news that shaped our region. Homicides take the lives of more than 100 people in Charlotte and become the focus of leaders who seem powerless to get it under control. UNC Charlotte suffers the senseless tragedy of a mass shooting on campus with two students losing their lives. Politically, voters say no to a sales tax for the arts, and the 9th Congressional District saga consumes most of the year, ending with a new election, a new candidate, and a new victor. CMS fires another superintendent under a shroud of secrecy. Charlotte gains a new bank headquarters, and the region gains a new team, soccer, even as the Panthers have a terrible season that takes down Coach Ron Rivera. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this table for this year-end roundup of the stories that made news this year is Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News. You should know the answer to that.
With Happy New Year.
Okay, thank you.
She is here.
She is here.
Present.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Joe Bruno is reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9, Eyewitness News, and one of the Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 award winners.
Hi, Mike.
Big title. And Eric Spanberg is back again. Yeah. He's.
Bad penny.
He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for being here. If there was one story that permeated this year, it was Charlotte's climbing homicide count. As the year ends, it's in triple digits, but still lower than the record 129 murders in Charlotte in 1993, when the population was about half of what it is today. So put this into context. It's bad, but how bad really is it?
Well, we may not be threatening, or we may not break the record, but remember, there were only 58 homicides only. I mean, every homicide's awful, but there were 58 in 2018. And when you get over 100 the following year, obviously that's not the direction you want to go. And I think there were so many homicides that really captured the community's attention this year, too. As I said, all of them are horrible, but when you think about Scott Brooks with the Brooks Sandwich Shop, when you think about Darnell Harris, the cook at the Steak and Shake, who was murdered during a robbery, when you think about the young woman, I think her name was Kendall Crank, who was a young mother who was shot in rush hour traffic on North Tryon Street. These things really captured people's attention and showed them in the starkest way how awful the violence has gotten in Charlotte.
Glenn.
I think what's different this time, and you're correct, that the homicide count has been higher when we were a much smaller city, but then we kind of knew what was driving it. The nation, including
Drugs.
Charlotte,
back
yeah,
then.
We were in the middle of a drug epidemic.
Yeah.
And now we can't say that to the same degree that we could then. So that's what's really disconcerting about the jump this year.
What do you think? I think there's an undercurrent of anger that permeates the culture. Black, white, rich, poor, we're just angry about everything, and we live in the richest society in the world. Why are we so darned angry?
I agree, and that's kind of what Chief Putney has said is the reason behind the spike in homicides this year. It's just arguments over stupid stuff that just leads to violence for some reason.
I might want to say,
and we're armed.
I always get very defensive when people blame the media, but I think the media is to blame for this. I really do. I think that the constant stream and just the existence of the constant stream of news that's become highly politicized on at least two cable channels, and the constant violence that you see in entertainment television and movies. I'm telling
that's
you,
going,
I think that
been
leads
going
into
on
it.
For decades, and we're not hearing
like
a lot
this.
About shootings that are over political arguments. You know, these a lot of them are acquaintances.
But that makes people angry. I just think people are angry all the time.
I do think there's a breakdown of all of our social institutions that maybe might have provided a place where you could come together. But
right. But
is it a direct cause? I couldn't claim that.
I have to point out as well that while we are in triple digits in terms of criminal homicides, there were at least another 11 killings that where prosecutors and police declined to press charges. They were ruled justifiable homicides, people perhaps protecting property, protecting other people. But I think those need to be considered when you look at the entire picture of violence in Charlotte. There were the criminal homicides, but we also saw at least 11 people who felt threatened enough to take another life.
Right,
and that those should not be overlooked.
You mentioned, Eric, the tragic shooting of Kendall Crank, who was a 27-year-old mom who was simply shot for being in the wrong place at the wrong time as she was on her way to pick up her kids. But there was another shooting very similar to that. Dr. John Holliday, who's the chairman and the founder and CEO of Dispose RX, who was walking uptown to a business meeting. He doesn't even live here. Walking to a business meeting, past the epicenter, got in the crossfire of an argument between teenagers, shot, killed, lost his life as a result of it. And it did not get the kind of reaction that I thought it would get. It was in broad daylight.
Yeah, it was on a Monday afternoon. I agree with you. I guess I'm contradicting myself a little bit. Some of these really did capture the public's attention. At the same time, there is a numbness, a weariness, and it stands out to me in the fact that we had city elections this year, and really, until the swearing in, the violence really wasn't even mentioned. And then all of a sudden, when we got to Mayor Lyles taking her oath and some of the council members, Malcolm Graham's, one of the councilmen, said it's a public health crisis. The mayor said there would be a council review to better help neighborhoods in terms of areas of violence. But overall, Mike, it was really quiet politically in a city where all this violence is breaking out. And to go back to your original point, to think that that happened in uptown Charlotte during a work day in such a business town, and it really just only made a few ripples, is hard to believe.
I think relative to many of the other homicides, that one did get a fair amount of attention. I think part of it is that as a nation, we're just becoming more desensitized to gun violence, period.
Yeah.
We have people who go into schools and shoot people, shoot children, and it's almost become commonplace.
Kerr Putney, CMPD chief, has expressed frustration throughout the year for the lack of cooperation with the police department gets from those in the community who might know who some of the perpetrators of this violence happen to be, and that could help them more quickly bring them to justice, and to find a way to get, he's frustrated about finding a way to get young people to stop using guns to solve petty disputes.
What we're seeing is 18 to 24-year-old young males are the people who are losing their lives mostly, and the people who are taking those lives. And it's generally over small things like an argument over a girlfriend or $20, a small amount of marijuana, very minor conflicts that people decide to use a gun to resolve. And that's the disappointing part.
WBTV boiled down the facts of these murders and found the majority of 2019's homicides are over petty crimes, a dispute over $20, a murder over a minor car accident, a social media post, a fast food meal, a disagreement between roommates, an argument over a boyfriend, a fistfight over a comment made in passing, and several drug murders over marijuana. So aside from this country's undercurrent of anger, do you think anybody has any clue how to solve this ongoing problem in 2020?
Well, I think that one of the clues that's very divisive, of course, is the proliferation of guns. And, you know, when we get into this conversation, whether it's locally, state level, federal level, people dig in and they take their respective sides. And so nothing really seems to change. There's not middle ground, or if there's middle ground, it has not been reached yet.
A lot of the people who are committing these killings also have criminal records. I think the other half of the criminal justice system, as Chief Putney likes to say, I think they have to take more responsibility as well. One of the things that the chief did this year was he announced that homicide suspects would no longer be eligible for electronic ankle bracelets to be released back onto the streets. I think most people are going to think that's a good idea.
And the courts and the prosecuting folks and even the public defenders are chronically understaffed and underfunded throughout the state of North Carolina.
And there really are, I think, two contradictory trends going on here, in that we are justifiably concerned about how many people are incarcerated in the United States. Right. And we don't want to just for that to be the first response to every crime. But yet, when you have someone who has a criminal record and then they cross the line into violence, into homicide, you're going to ask, why weren't they locked up?
Joe.
Something to watch in 2020. The mayor says starting in January, they're going to take a deep dive into the data to figure out where all these homicides were and what they can do to prevent another year.
Don't we know? I asked this question before when we talked about this in when she first made that announcement. Why do we need another study? Don't we know? Wouldn't a simple cursory look at the police reports tell you where the problems are?
Yeah, but I don't think it'll take a cursory look to figure out how to answer those questions that we have and the problems that we're seeing.
I think the other thing that's interesting that came out of the swearing-in night, Tark Bakary, Republican councilman, talked about having a united effort locally to go to the legislature and ask for more help from that other half that Glenn is talking about. If that were to happen, I think that could obviously make a huge difference. We'll see if there's enough consensus and will to do that.
Is 2019 an aberration, or will we see a continuation of this, do you think, in 2020?
I think it's really hard to say because I don't know, like you said, there was not one big dramatic thing that happened between 2018 and 2019 to explain almost a doubling of the homicide
rate. I asked that question of Chief Putney when I interviewed him recently. He didn't make a solid prediction about 2020, but he did say he does not think this is a new normal.
Okay. That's good to hear. I suppose, however, it was inevitable, but it was still shocking this year when Charlotte became part of the epidemic of school shootings as a student at UNC Charlotte or a former student at UNC Charlotte stormed into a classroom and began firing at fellow students.
All of a sudden, without warning, no one yelled, no one nothing, just guns started ringing out.
I just see like 30 to 50 kids just like running like a stampede towards me, screaming like, there's a shooter, there's a shooter.
And I call my parents to, you know, let them know I love them. And then I hear everyone get on the floor.
The shooter was subdued by 21-year-old Riley Howell, who lost his life as the result of those heroic efforts, and 19-year-old Reed Parlier was also shot and killed. Four others were injured in this incident that occurred on the last day of the spring semester in April. What has been the result of that shooting?
Well, certainly UNC Charlotte has done a number of things to try to adjust its security measures and the way it alerts people. I don't think there was any huge failing on the part of UNC Charlotte. And the Observer recently had an article talking about their head of security, who is from the military, and saying, you have to preserve in a military base, you've got guns, you've got, you know, guard stations. That's not how a university needs to be. You need to keep an atmosphere of openness and discussion and try to keep the students and faculty safe.
We saw increased measures not just there, but also with CMS this year.
Yeah. Phil Dubois, UNC Chancellor Phil Dubois, called April 30th, 2019, the saddest day in UNC Charlotte's history. The perpetrator, however, was quickly taken into custody. He made a full confession, according to investigators. He said, I just went into a classroom and shot the guys. That's a quote. His grandfather described him as autistic and socially reserved. He's been charged with 2 counts of murder, 4 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 4 counts of assault with a deadly weapon intended to kill, 1 count of having a gun on education property, 1 count of discharging a firearm on education property. We have 45 seconds left. Has a motive yet been determined?
No, and he has pleaded guilty. He will spend life in prison, although he will not face the death penalty. He watched videos, reportedly, of school shootings. He was frustrated by student debt, but none of it adds up to a logical motive. There was no vendetta against that class, those students, that professor, none of that.
So it could be another case of a young person being mentally disturbed in some way and having access to a gun and using it. Another problem that we haven't solved in this country, I suppose. The 9th District was major news all year long, it seemed, and into the previous year. The arts tax defeated, of course, and gerrymandering was a story. We'll talk about all those when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the year-round roundup here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Gathered around the table, Joe Bruno, reporter for WSSC-TV, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher QCityMetro.com, and Doss Helms, education reporter for WFAE News, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. A lot of last year, or this year, still this year, was consumed with something that should have been settled in 2018, the 9th Congressional District race. Here are names that we heard frequently throughout the year: McCray Dallas, Dan McCready, Dan Bishop, John Harris, and Mark Harris.
It's become clear to me that the public's confidence in the 9th District seat general election has been undermined to an extent that a new election is warranted.
That is Mark Harris, who won a squeaker of an election against Democrat Dan McCready, but after a hearing that turned on the testimony of Mark Harris's son, John, even Mark Harris had to admit that a new election was needed and that he ought not be the candidate. Has North Carolina ever experienced anything like this?
No, and I don't think the country has either.
Wow. We're number one.
Well, it was that whole Bush-Gore affair in 2000, but it was pretty unusual.
And I don't know, is Dan McCready the only person who's managed to lose the same election twice?
After campaigning for 27 months, yes, that's quite a feat.
Well, Harris's decision not to run resulted, obviously, in former Republican State Senator Dan Bishop deciding to run, and he became the GOP candidate. And he defeated Dan McCready again, this time by a slightly wider margin than the first time, by 2 points. In the previous election, the first one with Mark Harris, Democrat Dan McCready won 6 of 8 counties in the 9th District, except for Union and Bladen, which was the epicenter of the election fraud. In the redo, Bishop won Union and Bladen, flipped Richmond and Cumberland, and did better than Harris in Robeson County. And since moderate McCready had effectively at the time been running for what? Almost 2 years by that point, maybe a little over 2 years. And since Bishop is widely viewed as the most conservative member of the state Senate, at least when he was in the state Senate, and the architect of HB2, what does his victory say about politics in North Carolina?
Bishop won primarily because of Robeson County. That's a county where Democrats are outnumbered Republicans 10 to 1. Bishop managed to keep it within 1,000 votes, I'm pretty sure. And he won most of the Lumbee Indian tribe precincts toward the western part or the eastern part of the county. And that allowed him to win the election because he focused on those counties toward the coast and not necessarily running a Charlotte-based strategy. He essentially just gave Charlotte to McCready, and he focused on the rest of the counties in that district.
It's interesting, though. You're talking about a race where you had, when Harris beat McCready by 900 votes, 283,000, give or take, voted. And then you have about 191,000 vote the second time around because it's a special election. And McCready loses by 3,800. So, and you're right, Joe. Other than Charlotte, McCready really didn't have traction.
Right. So it's the fact that he picked up the Lumbee vote, the Lumbee Indian vote, is that an indication that they are a member of that coalition that feels aggrieved and therefore attracted to the Trump style of politics and what Trump has promised people, and by extension, Dan Bishop, because Trump came and campaigned for Dan Bishop?
Something Bishop said resonated with them. We haven't really taken a deep dive into what flipped the Lumbee precincts to Bishop, but I also do think that Trump's visit the day before in Fayetteville helped motivate that part of the district to support Bishop.
But you also had national media saying this shows Trump's weakness in the area. If he came and campaigned personally and it was still so close, so everything can be cast two ways. I think it also shows, unfortunately, the power of negative advertising. I mean, I think everybody remembers the little schoolyard nickname that was given by the Congressional Leadership Fund ads, and you've probably got people who are in their cars now singing the little greedy Dan McCready jingle that they hammered that home and they kept at it, and I think that probably influenced some people.
So back in Mecklenburg County, voters resoundingly rejected a referendum to increase the sales tax by a quarter cent from 7.25% to 7.5%. That money would have gone to support the Arts and Science Council, Parks and Greenways, and education. It would have brought in about $50 million a year in the good times, half of which would have gone to the arts. This whole thing felt hasty and not very well thought out, Is that why voters rejected, or was there something else at play
here? I agree with you. Having covered a lot of those meetings, it did feel hasty and slipshod, and it felt like they were often putting this together as it was in process. And remember, Mike, you were also in a year in which you'd had a property revaluation. You'd had the county opted not to go with a revenue-neutral tax rate. And even though the city did go with revenue-neutral, a majority of homeowners still were paying higher city taxes because the value had gone up so much. And I think there was a lot of tax fatigue and fee fatigue, and then you see this rolled out, and it's not really clear exactly how the numbers are going to shake out, and people said, no thanks.
I think in the just playing on what Eric just said, I think in the best of all times, it's difficult to get people to vote for higher taxes, no matter how worthy the cause may be. And I think this situation was no different.
I mean, this the hastiness and the sloppiness of how this was all put together, it was a one-time only tax increase. If voters had said yes, that's the only time we could ever raise the sales tax again, according to state law. There were other needs that kept coming up, like housing problems. All sales taxes are regressive. It would have hit the poor harder than it would have hit the wealthy. There was no settled mechanism for distribution of the money, at least for the arts, once it was collected. The ballot language was unspecific. It didn't tell you a darn thing about how that money was going to be used. There was no guarantee that a future county commission would continue to use the money for the purposes we held the election. And it made for some strange bedfellows. There were Republicans and Democrats on both sides, conservatives and liberals on both sides. What does that tell you about this?
It was just all of it was quite unusual between the allies, the way it was put together. And some of it was not the fault of those campaigning for the tax. Remember, the state legislature set that mandate that you could not have any descriptive language other than do you right. want a higher tax. Another factor I think that creeps into this, Mike, is transit. I think a lot of people are wondering what happens with the Silver Line, what happens with other light rail expansion, and they look around and say, well, the transit tax can't pay for it now, and you only have this one-time right. shot at a half cent. Why spend it on the arts?
And another thing that kept coming up was the potential for having to build a new football stadium, which is going to happen, by the way. There's no question. We'll talk about that later. But would there be an appetite, do you think, for raising the sales tax to support that, or to support cats, for that matter?
I think cats, you might have a better shot at getting taxpayers to support a sales tax increase for light rail than a football stadium. But I don't think it helped that the city had the conversation about the Silver Line just weeks before people went to the ballot box to decide this, because then people were putting that apples to apples, you know, comparison. Would I rather have a sales tax increase go to a Silver Line or to the parks, arts, and education? They had such a fundraising advantage, the four group, too, and they never really could nail that message down. The anti-sales tax group, they had like $20 donations. Like, they, I don't know if they ever did they get into four digits. I'm not sure.
They had $1,500, Joe, and $1,000 of it was for Matthew Ridenour compared to $830,000 for the other side. You're absolutely right. That's an incredible disparity, and still they lost.
And it was kind of this odd advertising campaign in which it emerged as an art sales tax, but they pitched it as education and parks and greenways.
But of course.
Right, and I think...
Let's be duplicitous.
Right, and if you were inclined to not trust them, I think that was viewed as another reason not to trust them.
Yeah. When you look at the amount that would be raised from that tax, that's not going very far to build any light rail.
Right.
So I don't think that was so much the issue. I think it really just boiled down to people not willing to vote for more taxes.
So prior to the vote, we kept being told that the Arts and Science Council, which has been the principal fundraiser for years for anything having to do with local arts and sciences, that they were in crisis, that their funding model had completely collapsed. And shortly after the no vote was apparent, they laid off people at the Arts and Science Council. Now that the dust has settled, what is their financial picture and that of the organizations and the individuals that they support?
Well, they haven't really given much of a public update. You know, Jeep Bryant, who came in the summer to run the ASC, made it clear that if this didn't pass, they were going to have to find other ways to bridge the gap. He wasn't definitive about it, I assume, because they were hoping this tax would pass. But clearly, they do have financial problems. I don't think there are many people who have delved into this that don't see an issue for ASC and the arts groups, principally because, much like the United Way, they used to get most of their money from workplace giving campaigns. Those simply are not or they just don't work anymore. I think they're down something like 75%. So they have to do something. What they're going to do, I have no idea.
So not only were we the epicenter of national news because of the 9th Congressional District race, we were also in the national news over gerrymandering, both the legislative and congressional levels of gerrymandering. Courts called for the redrawing of legislative and congressional districts. Because of all of this, political gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering. As we end the year, what has been the result? And what will these new districts mean for the future? Because they've all been redrawn.
Well, we have new districts for both the state House and Senate races, as well as the U.S. congressional districts. From the U.S. congressional side, it looks like Democrats can pick up two seats, one in Greensboro, one in Raleigh. Not a whole lot of impact for Charlotte there. State House, state Senate seats, I believe there's a slight advantage. A couple Democratic seats can be picked up in the House and Senate. I believe it's pretty much the same. Am I right on that?
Yes, and it doesn't look, for example, this is not so radical that it looks like Democrats are going to take majorities in either chamber, for example. The 8-5 versus 10-3, when you talk about the congressional delegation, is big nationally, though, of course, you know, as the Republicans are looking to take over the House again. So this will be significant. I think the other thing that's interesting about this, Mike, is that it was all done in a matter of a couple weeks. You know, judges said, look, you're going to do this. You're going to do it in public. Again, as we've mentioned on the show, you could have streamed it live. What a way to spend a weekend. but they did actually do it. I mean, they did it pretty quickly. They reached consensus and they move forward, which is progress after how many years and how many dozens of lawsuits and appeals. At least they did make some progress.
So this is all going to happen again really quickly because of the 2020 census. So will they be using this transparent streaming in your face? Here, we're going to draw it for you publicly. Let me get my box of Crayolas. Will they be doing this that way again, or will they go back behind closed doors as they did before and try to pull a fast one?
That's a really good question. a really good question.
Tell me what happens in the election next year.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how.
Look
it's
into your
done.
Crystal ball, and
so that this is not going to be a template for future drawing of districts, which are going to be redrawn because of the census.
I guess my question is whether this is going to be the template once someone fights it. If they can prove that there is, you know, an unfair degree of gerrymandering, will this instantly revert to, okay, we're going to do it this way?
I think it would be hard to immediately go back to get to your question specifically. I think it would be hard to immediately go back in such a short period to the kind of winner-take-all, we'll-do-it-our-way approach to drawing lines. So I'm hopeful, optimistic, that this will serve as a template.
So one thing you can count on from CMS is a bombshell, just when you need it. Another year, another bombshell departure at CMS after the mysterious departure of Superintendent Heath Morrison a few years ago and the quiet hiring of Clayton Wilcox to be superintendent after a good review, a contract extension, a raise earlier this year. Clayton Wilcox got the boot with no explanation. The school board always says they have to be quiet because of state law. And is that true?
Well, if he had been dismissed, if he had been fired, they would have had to have a dismissal letter that would be public record. And I think they could have insisted on, you know, what they did was go behind closed doors and say whatever they said about why we want you to leave. And he said, I'll leave. He did not get any extra severance. He walked out the door and they agreed not to talk about it. With that agreement, they didn't have much other choice. So they could have either said, no, we are going to fire you. We are going through this process. It probably would have cost the taxpayers a lot of money.
Yeah.
Or they could have said, we're going to accept your resignation, but we will not agree to this nondisclosure because there is a part of the public records law and the personnel law that says you can, if essentially the credibility, I'm not quoting the exact language, but if the credibility of the institution is at stake, you can opt to release information.
Wasn't it?
Some people would argue that it was.
You had the opportunity to conduct an exit interview with Mary McCray, who just recently left the school board as chair because she decided not to run again, and she defended in that interview the secrecy that shrouded the departure of the last two of our superintendents.
we have to also weigh whatever the opposing side, their attorney, is saying. Now, if either candidates had said, you know, we are not going to resign, we're going to go through with this, then we would have told everything. But you give them the option of how they want to do this. And I think everybody does it that way, in a sense, rather than just going whole hog and, you know, exposing everything.
She told you that lots of times people are not always honest with you. And by that, she was referring to consulting firms that helped find the two previous superintendents who were mysteriously shown the door within 3 years of their hiring. And she said those firms had let the board down. I asked you this question a couple weeks ago. Does the board bear no responsibility in any of this?
I think they have to bear some. They choose the consulting firm. They actually had Ann Clark, who was an inside candidate who I think would have been willing to take a longer-term contract, and they opted not to keep her on. They then looked at search firms, and they looked at the North Carolina School Boards Association, which is what Mary McRae said, in hindsight, would have been the better choice. They did not go with that choice. They went with another national search firm. They got Clayton Wilcox. Apparently, he was the best of the applicants they brought in, and within 2 years, they had, or I guess just a little over 2 years, they had decided he was not a good choice.
As opposed to the previous searches, they did not use a consulting firm to name Ernest Winston, the new superintendent, because he was with the system. He was an ombudsman for the and he was just named. They didn't do a search at all. The day after he was named acting superintendent, he's now the full superintendent, Mr. Winston appeared on this program, and because at the time many were upset about the lack of transparency about his predecessor's dismissal, I flat out asked him why Clayton Wilcox was dismissed.
Well, I cannot speak to that. What I am focused on is moving forward, stabilizing.
But everybody's focused on moving forward. And in these instances, it seems to me to be really bad public relations to just focus on moving forward. People have a need. I think it's a need, not just a right. It's a need to know what's going on over there. What the hell is going on over there?
Well, Mike, to that, I will leave that dialogue to our board members, because that's in their area of responsibility.
So the system is moving forward, and a new board and a new chair have been ensconced in all of this. Should we expect any difference in their approach moving forward?
Well, I think we're going to see what happens with Ernest Winston. You know, he got a 3-year contract, but kind of under the radar, something they did not talk about when they signed it was the fact that, unlike the others, where if they wanted to get rid of a superintendent, they had to buy him out unless there was certain causes spelled out, they can just tell Ernest Winston, thanks, but we want somebody else with 60 days notice.
Some other things about Wilcox's departure came out much later, thanks to the Charlotte Observer's investigation. But that's a chapter we have turned the page on. When we come back, we'll talk about more banking in Charlotte, more affordable housing in Charlotte, and more teams in Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the year-end roundup with Andos Helms, our education reporter here at WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSSC-TV, Channel 9, Eyewitness News. And Glenn Berkins is editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com. Phil Dubois, who was deeply affected by the shootings at UNC Charlotte this past year, announced his retirement after 15 years as the chancellor at the school. And he said, quote, "I feel very blessed to have been chancellor for this long, and I simply wanted to go out on my own terms, and that's what we're going to do," end quote. So was this just because the time was right for him personally after 15 years, which is a long time at the helm of a school that size, or was it, did it have anything to do with the changes in philosophy and direction that we're witnessing at the university system up in Raleigh with the board of directors?
Well, I'm always hesitant to speculate on whether somebody means what they say, and I don't know Phil Dubois well enough to even have a good speculation. He certainly has said that he has accomplished a lot with the university. There's been a lot of growth. There's been expansion. You know, he says it's time to go. He's only the fourth chancellor that they've had since the university was created just after World War II. You know, 15 years, that's not a 2 or 3 year cycle like we see in certain other educational institutions. This is a reasonable tenure. So, and he's giving a full year for them to do a search. So I think it seems reasonable that he's making this choice.
And among his accomplishments were football, the addition of football to the sport athletic program, and the arrival of the Lynx Blue Line, which he had a great deal to play in behind the scenes. Has anyone been named as his replacement?
I don't believe so. I believe they are still doing the search.
Well, banking is back. Charlotte is back. We're number two. Charlotte exits 2019 with another banking headquarters, the result of the merger of two titans, Winston-Salem's BB&T and Atlanta's SunTrust. The new bank will be called Truist, unless Truliant gets its way. They'll be housed in a building that they bought for that purpose, the Hearst Tower, which will be renamed the Truist Tower in town. That's a superlative.
By the way, Mike, does that make us Avis as a city? I guess it does, right?
Yes, because it makes us solidly the number two banking center in the country. So what does the presence, other than that, mean for this region?
Other than being the Avis of American cities, which is a proud distinction, most importantly, it brings 2,000 jobs. It also brings another large banking headquarters. This is a $66 billion merger. This is a bank that is, I think, will be the sixth largest bank now that they are together. So anytime you can bring a company of that size, and oh, by the way, without one drop of incentives, you have to like that.
Yep. So what is this new bank? What will this new bank be able to do that the two banks on their own could not?
Well, I mean, they just have more financial might. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, anytime you have more resources to work with, you can do more things. So they just have more clout, more influence, and hopefully they're going to keep growing. Of course, that's what the CEOs are saying right off the bat. We'll see if they can live up to that. But certainly, at first blush, what's not to like?
So 2019 was the year that it finally happened. They finally opened the I-77 toll lanes, although work on those lanes will continue into 2020 and probably 2029. But now that these controversial lanes are open, what has been the verdict?
It provides a reliable travel time for people who are able to afford tolls that can reach as high as $10 one direction. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. The company is still being fined $30,000 a day because that work has not been finished. And at last check, it's at more than $1.5 million in fines.
When are they scheduled to be? And by finished, that means the repaving of the free lanes on I-77, right?
Correct.
Okay, when will that be done?
We don't have a timeline for that. They have not, but I mean, this whole project was supposed to be done at the start of this year, so and we're not close yet.
And how soon will work begin on toll lanes heading south on 77 toward South Carolina?
I think we have a couple more years. We have to go through the CRTPO process
that
before
is the plan,
we get there.
Right?
That is the plan, eventually.
Great.
You hear the excitement in everyone's voice.
It's I-77 in the airport, you know, perpetual construction.
As Panther losses mounted this season in the absence of franchise quarterback Cam Newton, head coach Ron Rivera's run came to an end, and the timing surprised even Ron Rivera.
If anything, I thought it would happen at the end of the season, to be honest with you. You know, I know you talked about doing some things differently, and I get that. That's part of the business of owning a football team. And at the end of the day, you know, when you lose football games, when you have a chance to win them, that's a tough pill to swallow.
He was touted by everybody who was quoted by anybody anywhere as one of the nicest people in the league. And he was let go prior to the end of the season, in part because David Tepper said he wanted to be nice to the guy. He didn't want him hanging out there knowing that the end was coming. Just cut your losses and move on so he could find another job, which he will. Rivera was dealt some pretty tough blows this season because of injuries. And he is the winningest coach the Panthers have ever had. So will David Tepper have trouble finding someone better?
It's going to be probably the most attractive job on the market. I think so.
Why?
I mean, we have a lot of talent on the team. I mean, who doesn't want to coach CMC? The reason he let go Rivera so early in the year is because he wanted to start the coaching search and he didn't want to go behind his back. So he's probably talking to some college coaches right now or coaches that are retired or currently out of a job in the NFL market because you can't talk to a current coach employed. That would be tampering. But I do think the Carolina job will be very attractive. It's kind of sad, though, that the team – I didn't think it would be possible for this team to get any worse than when it hit rock bottom losing to the Redskins, but we're just still spiraling out of control here. I mean,
and even the players are angry about
right.
it. Tepper has said that he will not tolerate mediocrity, and when you put that kind of money into something, why should you? Who else, though, is on the chopping block? Well, are we going to see major wholesale changes? If you're changing the coach, maybe the manager, aren't you going to change the team?
Yeah, the whole coaching staff, the general manager. I mean, a lot of the players
roster,
probably won't be
huge
brought
roster
back.
Turnover.
Yeah.
This is going to be interesting because, you know, David Tepper has been so well received in Charlotte since he's been here for various things he's done, both with the Panthers and some of his other ventures here. But this now will be on him. This is going to be his coach. This will be his team. And it's interesting. At one point, he gathered a bunch of us together and said, look, no more mediocrity. We got to turn this around. People have watched this for 25 years of, you know, never having consecutive winning seasons. This has to happen quickly. And then the day that he fired Rivera, I asked him a question about, well, so how quickly can you do this? And he said, hey, look, this is not an overnight thing. So I think he's getting a little taste of NFL life as well.
These are 21st century problems.
Yes.
This was first world problems. This was also the year that Tepper struck a deal with South Carolina to put the football team's headquarters and practice facilities in Rock Hill. South Carolina gave the team $160 million toward that effort. Does that include the interstate highway interchange they're going to put in, or is that just for the stuff in Rock Hill, or do we know?
I'm trying to remember. The interstate, I thought, was part of that because they were borrowing from several different government funds to cobble that together.
So what will this project mean for that area of South Carolina?
I think it's going to change the way Rock Hill looks. I mean, not just physically, but just in terms of, you know, the way Rock Hill feels about itself. When they had the celebratory event, you could tell that people were so excited about it. It's not just going to be for the Panthers. Obviously, they'll have high school football. They're going to build hotels and offices and all these things. So if it works, it could really be, dare I use that horrible word, transformative, we'll see.
And yes. I think it will knit the two cities together even more closely. They've been growing closer over the decades. But
suffocating Fort Mill in the process?
Perhaps. That's a good point.
It's a movie of the week, Suffocating Fort Mill.
So there are implications for Charlotte, too. If you read between the lines, you can clearly see that if Charlotte doesn't pony up for a new stadium a few years from now, he'll just build it in Rock Hill. And that became evident when he announced the acquisition of Major League Soccer. He says if the city changes his mind about the $110 million it promises for stadium enhancements and for allowing him to put the soccer team's headquarters and practice facility at the old Eastland Mall site, again, he has, quote, lots of land in Rock Hill. So because of his personality, it sounds non-threatening, but it isn't, is it?
I would be shocked if anyone thinks he wouldn't just take his soccer balls and move them a little bit south. But I think that this, when I'm talking about the MLS project, it is so vital to the east side and what they have tried to do with that Eastland Mall site. They've had no success. I would be shocked if the city walked away from that.
But in all fairness, I think it's much easier to move an NFL team to South Carolina than it would be to move a startup soccer franchise.
Why? Well, you could just build it from the ground up in Rock Hill.
Well, not the logistics. You're trying to build a fan base.
Okay.
And Major League Soccer has not worked universally in every place it's gone. So I think he needs Charlotte to make this franchise grow and be popular. I think Rock Hill just might be a bridge too far.
And I think it's actually the practice fields and the headquarters that he had talked about moving to Rock Hill, which I think could be done if he still played
the
games. But again, I just don't see the city having any interest in saying no to the Eastland development.
And of course, the fact that we were named the 30th expansion city in Major League Soccer's pantheon of stars, their constellation of teams, that was the big sports news, I guess, of the year. And they'll be out on the pitch. See, I've already learned the lingo. In 2021, and Tepper already sees a major rivalry between Charlotte and Atlanta.
There's another city down the road to the west. Charlotte is hot. Okay, we're the hot city. Screw that other city. Okay? We're gonna have one hell of a rivalry.
This guy is all in on Charlotte, and he has a vision for what he'd like the city to become, the sports and entertainment capital of the Carolinas. Are the people who can help him make that happen on board, too?
I think at the moment everybody's on board.
And, better get on board. And hang on by your fingernails.
You know, the amazing thing is, as we're talking about this, you know, his NFL team has lost 7 weeks in a row, and yet people are so excited about his, not just his wallet, but his attitude. Remember, this is a franchise that had an owner who basically didn't speak to anybody for 25 years, and I think people are just sort of starving for some attention to see that the owner cared. And when you hear statements like that as a fan, I think people think, oh, okay, he's on board. He wants this to go well.
Maybe Michael Jordan could take a cue from his behavior. Where is Michael Jordan? Has anybody seen Michael Jordan ever? Okay. Democratic Governor Roy Cooper and the Republican-controlled legislature spent most of the year wrangling over the budget. The argument centered around teacher pay. The governor wanted more. The legislature said we've already given them enough. They still don't have a budget, do they?
They do not. They have pieced together large parts of it, but they don't have an actual whole united budget. So apparently they're going to come back to this in 2020 as the second half of the fiscal year begins.
So are there winners or losers in this at the moment?
Well, I think, and the real deadlock was not teacher pay, it was Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
And teacher pay was what got caught in that crossfire, because that was the thing that both of them wanted to point at the others and say, you didn't give teachers raises. And that's exactly what happened, was that the teachers got a fairly small raise. Roy Cooper said, no, it's too small, I'm not signing on to this.
It's just dueling press releases is what it turned into.
And tweets and everything else, right, yes. Press conferences.
Yes.
There was also a high-profile police shooting this year when officers were called to a fast food restaurant where they confronted a man named Doncurius Franklin, who was allegedly holding a gun when they arrived. After some tense moments, all of which appeared on body cam footage that we all saw, it appeared that Mr. Franklin was complying with officers' demands to drop his gun when an officer fired and killed him. Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather and a dozen prosecutors unanimously decided they could not convince a jury that Officer Wendy Curl was not justified in shooting him and decided not to press charges. Just a week or so ago, however, the Citizens Review Board, which reviews police shootings, among other things, voted to move forward with a fact-finding hearing in Franklin's death. Given the department's own review department determined no wrongdoing under Officer Curls on her part and took no disciplinary action, what could the review board uncover? Where could this go?
Well, the review board takes a look at to make sure that internal policies and see if there's anything that can be improved in the future, just to see if anything can be learned from this. They obviously can't overturn the district attorney's decision, but they can see whether the officer erred in her judgment by using lethal force.
Recommend more changes in procedure, which they've already done this year, right?
That's what I was going to say, Mike. I think this case points right to one of the most important issues in town, which is we had the whole discussion about de-escalation. There was the written policy. Chief Putney hosted this big press conference and said this is an important step. And yet we have cases like this where he still says a gun is a game changer.
So digital technology continues to wreak havoc on traditional media and news outlets here and around the country. You know, Ann, I know you've been watching with some sadness the layoffs going on at your former place of employment, the Charlotte Observer, and you've speculated for months here that the print edition is in danger. And, of course, recently McClatchy, the Observer's parent company, announced the paper would join others in the chain and stop publication of the Saturday print newspaper beginning in March. What does that say to you?
Well, I think it says that we are going from an environment that you and I grew up with where there was a newspaper or maybe even two newspapers in town that were the sun around which all the other media planets revolved, to a much more mixed scene. It's almost more like the restaurant scene. You know, some things are going away, new things are popping up. We've seen Charlotte Agenda, which was a very lifestyle-focused digital publication, hire some really high-power people, including from The Observer and from Charlotte Magazine. We've seen Tony Macia, a former Observer business reporter, launching a business newsletter that's breaking news. Glenn Birkins here has been on the forefront of that digital only for a while. All sorts of broadcast media are doing strong, and the Observer is still doing great things.
Yes, and the rise of grant-funded partnerships that are helping hire reporters for special projects and just beat reporters. And finally, as the Panthers end their losing season, there is some good news. The Hornets are doing pretty well, and the Checkers won the 2019 Calder Cup, which goes to the playoff champions of the American Hockey League. It's the oldest continuously awarded professional ice hockey trophy. It's been presented since 1936, and this year, it is ours. Andos Helms, Glenn Birkins, Joe Bruno, Eric Spanberg, thank you all for the hour, and Happy New Year. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.